Hello and welcome to the latest of our webinars. I'm honoured we have Shantanu Majumdar, whose talent recognised by the acquisition of Silk Just, looking at practice and procedure in the business and property courts. Shantanu is going to give us the feel of it, and I'm going to then have a look at the, I have to say, troubled experiment with disclosure in those very courts. But let's get on and see what the hell it's all about, Shantanu.
Yes, well, with that introduction, I realise that I am bound to disappoint.
Nay.
I was reflecting on what to say about the business of property courts, and looking back over my now very lengthy career, and one of the things that I remember is that in the old days, and I mean the early 1990s, there was seemed to me to be a very hard and fast division between the Chancery Division and the Queen's Bench Division.
Yes.
You know, you go to the Bear Garden, and this is pre-Wolf, of course, when the courts are much busier. And I'm not sure I ever saw anyone come to blows, but it's a kind of thing that must have happened and could easily happen. There were so many people there.
Yes.
And the judge in chambers sat there. Somebody would come occasionally from the Chancery Division, and you could tell immediately because they looked rather phased, maybe even slightly intimidated.
Yes. Do you think they were much more sort of genteel?
Absolutely.
Yes.
And, you know, I remember seeing, certainly as a pupil, experiences in different courts. And, you know, in a Chancery Division trial, someone would have it put to them that they were lying, but with no theatre.
No.
Blink and you miss it, whereas of course you wouldn't make that mistake in Queen's Bench.
I put it to you, you're a damned lying cad and bounder.
Yeah. That sort of thing. Yeah. And I remember, I mean, I think probably lots of people claim to remember this story, but the door opening to Master Hodgson's room in the Queen's Bench corridor, you know, back in 1991, may he rest in peace, to see literally a copy of the White Book being thrown at hapless counsel, who clearly...
Yes. You know,
but all that has changed.
Yes. Well, because the thing with Hodgson is that people would turn up and say, it's in the White Book, and he'd throw it and then find it for me.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Yes, yes. With you know, and with how much violence depended on how it had been, you know, what side he got out of the bed that morning.
Yeah, yes, yes.
But I suppose the point I'm making is that there used to be a much kind of harder and faster division between Lincoln's Inn and the Temple, between the Queen's Bench Division and the Chancery Division, who did the work... where the work ended up, which has gradually over the years subsided.
Yes. And maybe the quality of judges, only that I did a trial long, long ago, even before then, before a person who was a member of your chamber, Sir Richard Scott, as was.
Yes.
And it was just a totally different pace and rhythm to the litigation and the way he conducted a trial.
Yes.
Where the QBED boys were just whizzing through it.
And,
No,
and I think that's changed for all sorts of reasons, and some of them have been kind of directed from the top in terms of kind of efficiency and getting on with things.
Sure.
But I just think, you know, movements between chambers, people coming from the Temple to Lincoln's Inn and vice versa, the sort of personalities, this sense that everybody does this sort of work now, rather than it, you know, on one side of the road there being this kind of practice.
Yes, this cross-fertilisation,
And that seemed to me to be quite a useful way of looking at this institution, if that's the right word, the Business and Property Courts of England and Wales.
Right.
Now, it's, and now we're onto the slides, thrilling slides as they are.
Yeah.
I mean, the origins, as far as I can see, of the Business and Property Courts lie in the Civil Court Structure Review, the final report of which was in 2016, and you'll remember that that was conducted or led by Lord Justice Briggs, as he then was. Perhaps he didn't mind doing it, but it made me think of Rupert Jackson and various people before him, and it strikes me that when you're a new member of the Court of Appeal, you need to keep your head down as you want to be
picked on and given some horrible
volunteered
task.
For some massive, wide-ranging review.
Yes.
But anyway, I think Briggs, with characteristic thoroughness, quite enjoyed what he was asked to do. And I suppose the clue is in the title. It's about structure. Now, I think, as they always say with these things, everything was on the table.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen that, I suppose, more recently with the review of witness statements.
Yes.
And I remember going to some presentation where a member of the committee said, well, everything's on the table, including the abolition of witness statements.
Which I thought was nonsense.
As a routine. But I think they just say that.
They
want to kind of encourage us to think that they've been thinking and considering
it. The unthinkable.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. But that was never going to happen.
No.
I think at a lower level, I mean, one of the perhaps slightly more extreme or seemingly extreme options or recommendations, as Lord Justice Briggs put it, was the abolition of the Queen's Bench Division and the Chancery Division as separate divisions, and so some kind of amalgamation.
Mm-hmm.
Less radically, and here I quote, he recommended, at least for consideration, what he described as moving the boundary between the two, and in particular renaming the Chancery Division to, and I quote again, to reflect its focus upon business and property work. And I think part of the thinking behind that was what he described as the greatly increased listing and ticketing of flexibility, enabling judges to sit frequently outside their division. Now, I suppose it's the last two of those options which ended up being combined in what has come to be known as the Business and Property Courts of England and Wales. And I'm not going to keep saying that.
We'll
call it BPC.
BPC, yes. And
that began in operation in October 2017. And it's like everything that, you know, when you get old enough, and you'll recognise this, everything you think was recent was longer ago than you thought it was. What is the BPC? And to some extent, that involves identifying what it isn't.
Yes.
It isn't a new court. It's a new kind of structure, or perhaps layer is the better word.
Right.
And what it does is not really to combine, but to create this layer, this structure, this kind of administrative body,
yes.
Which comprises four existing sets of courts. And first of all, there's the Commercial Court, and that includes the Admiralty Court. The Chancery Division Courts.
Yes.
And I emphasise the plural in that because, of course, what they had, already within the Chancery Division, one had a number of specialist courts, the Companies Court, the Patent Courts, and that sort of thing.
Right, right.
The Technology and Construction Court, the TCC.
Oh, the great, which, because when I was a child, was the official referees.
Absolutely.
Wonderful,
yes.
Wonderful.
And
yes.
I think it's true, did perhaps more than one case involving a dispute about its own building.
Yes.
but anyway.
Trailblazing. And yeah. It was in the TCC I first encountered exchanging witness statements, the miracle of giving people a trial date at the beginning of the litigation.
Yes.
I love the TCC and those judges, people like Edgar Fay, were wonderful.
No, I mean, looking back, you realise quite how influential its practices were, responding to a particular kind of difficulty in trying cases, has actually filtered through.
Yeah, and I mean, Lord Wolfe did many good things, but what he also did, frankly, was pilfer the TCC model. You know, active case management.
Yes.
All of that was going on in the mid-1980s.
Yeah, absolutely. The ORs.
Sorry. Yes. And then the Mercantile Courts.
The Mercantile Courts are now, of course, renamed the Circuit Commercial Courts, if anyone was wondering where those came from.
Yes.
So those are the kind of existing structures that are brought under this, and I think the Judicial Office refers to it as an umbrella.
Yes,
and
yes, I get that. That's
all
good.
Of these terms are kind of interchangeable. But that doesn't, I suppose, do justice to the sheer breadth of the kind of, you know, there's a layer below.
Yes.
Generally speaking, described under this new dispensation as lists, and those reflect the kind of work that the BPC is doing, who will try it, and where a particular case will be allocated. And so these lists, and I've listed them, I call them a list of lists.
Yes, that's accurate.
Are important because when you issue a case and you put the heading on your documents, you need to say where it should be listed and allocated.
Yes.
And I may or may not be the only person in this, well, I'm probably the only person in this room, but I may not be the only person who's involved in this webinar watching it who maybe still gets it wrong in terms of these rather complicated headings.
Because there are very, very subtle divides, are there not? And yes, you can see how a pension could be arguably financial services, or you know, there's a blurry divide.
Absolutely,
yes.
And there isn't necessarily consensus between parties about where the case is or should be, or where they thought it would be. I mean, I think it is now over, but a fraud case, which I would have thought would have been in the business list, and we'll see in a moment. But had and I think the powers that be had decided that it was a trusts case, presumably because we were making a proprietary claim.
Right.
And we only discovered this when we were trying to find a hearing on the daily cause list and could not find it in any of the familiar places. And I remember ringing up my clerk and saying, "Well, I don't think we're listed tomorrow." And they looked at it and they rang up the court and said, "Hey, we're listed under the trusts list."
Oh my God!
Those teething problems remain the case, at least for like me who are dinosaurs and are slow to adapt.
I'm a Neanderthal. Yes.
Absolutely. Well, quite. But anyway, going back to the list, we have the Admiralty Court, and then we have the lists. The business lists, and that has subdivisions: the pensions list, the financial services and regulatory lists. And as I say, those are, if you want to be careful, those should be identified when you issue your claim and every time you draw up an order. The commercial court, when you issue in the commercial court, you have the option, as you did with the mercantile courts, of issuing in the London Circuit Commercial Court or in one of the circuit commercial courts in other centres. And I'm going to come on to the other centres
right.
In a moment. There is then the competition list. And there's the financial list, so all familiar categories. Financial list is so important, we find it on two slides.
But it is important.
Insolvency and companies list, and again, that really represents the existing practice of the Chancery Division, which was that there were insolvency and companies courts. Intellectual property, and there, of course, there's a choice between the Patents Court and the IPEC, which is the Intellectual Property Enterprise Court, which generally hears some slightly smaller cases.
Yes. And that has some sort of fixed cost regime, I think, in passing.
Not my field.
There's certainly an angle in there, yes.
Yeah, and I think
cheap and cheerful,
efficient, smaller cases, etc. Yes. Property trusts and probate list, we've already touched on that with my fraud case. Perhaps it's worth mentioning that Lord Justice Briggs, and I suppose with his Chancery background, was very keen that even if there were a kind of renaming of the Chancery Division, it retained reference certainly to property, just to make it clear that that is kind of meat and drink.
Of course.
The revenue list and the technology and construction court as opposed to list. And that's when we stray back into the Queen's Bench Division. Of course, there's an element of geography about this. I mean, all of the courts in London who were doing that sort of work by the time of that structure review were based in the Rolls Building. So again, back to things having happened much longer ago than you've seen. This is 2011.
Goodness.
Rolls Building opened.
Right.
And I wonder, and I don't know whether he says this in his report, but I think there's a sense in which the BPC kind of builds on and maybe is kind of influenced by the fact that there is this geographical concentration of the courts doing that work in London anyway.
Yes. And good facilities because it is a new building.
Absolutely.
Yes.
I mean, even now I was thinking, actually, I suppose it's, for all its defects, I mean, it does seem to be holding up quite well, certainly compared to the OR's court.
Yes.
And there are no obvious leaks.
No.
The way the Judicial Office describes the Rolls Building, and is as the largest specialist centre for financial, business and property litigation in the world. Now, I'm not in a position to judge whether that was remains the case. I suspect it is, how busy an international litigation centre is.
Well, I dropped into, although of course they decided to go home early, the Hewlett-Packard litigation.
The autonomy.
Autonomy.
In the super court.
In the super court. And that's worth zillions of dollars, so it does attract... majorly important litigation.
Absolutely. Well, I think the whole kind of, perhaps that's the subject of a separate webinar. I mean, the whole question about London's primacy as an international dispute resolution centre and what's going to happen post-Brexit.
In the future,
Which I think is an interesting, and I suppose for those of us who do it, but more than interesting, maybe slightly kind of worrying question. Mm. Just going back to the Rolls Building and it being this international dispute resolution centre, I mean, that's very much the kind of subtext and made explicit in various parts of Lord Justice Briggs's report, making sure that the system was fit for purpose, but from as much as anything else, an international perspective.
Yes.
And he says in this slightly reticent but elusive way at the end of his report that it's for others to decide which, if any, of his options and recommendations to adopt. But he adds, in a slight sleight of hand, that if they are, then he thinks that this will secure the future of London as a dispute resolution centre.
A pretty clear steer.
Absolutely,
as to,
and a hint that was taken.
I think grabbed.
Absolutely. So that's the structure. What do the rules and the practice direction say about it? Well, there is a specific practice direction, 57AA, which applies to the Business and Property Courts. But it's rather restrained in effect because it specifically provides that all of the statutory provisions, rules, procedural rules, practice directions and guides that already apply to the various areas of work that I've already mentioned, the various lists and the other courts, will continue to apply. And although it says that the practice direction about the BPC prevails in the case of conflict with any other practice direction, the 57AA is mercifully short.
Good.
And so the scope for conflict ought to be fairly limited.
Right.
And what it mainly deals with is questions about where you issue, how you describe things, some of the things we've already touched on about what sort of work we're talking about and how it's allocated.
Mm-hmm.
Transfer.
Yes.
One of the purposes of the BPC is that it's meant to be a much more flexible structure, which, I mean, of course, is always possible to transfer between divisions and between district registries and London and vice versa, but not necessarily very easy to do. And I think the idea is that it should be easier. You know, if there's active case management is going on, somebody is considering every now and then whether it's most efficient for this case and the best use of resources for it to be in this list in this building before this judge.
Sure.
So that's part of the thinking, and that's one of the things that 57AA provides. Now, I mentioned already that there were regional centres.
Gosh, yes.
And they've grown. I think Newcastle and Cardiff were late to the party, or maybe Newcastle and Liverpool, I can't quite remember. But there are now seven places, Birmingham, Bristol, Leeds, Liverpool, Manchester, Newcastle and Cardiff, where there are existing High Court District Registries and there is now a BPC. And the Practice Direction 57AA does deal with where you issue as between London and one of these regional centres.
Because historically I think people were rather keen to issue in London.
Yes,
yes,
absolutely. And I'll come on in a
right,
moment.
Right, go find
well, no, well, I, no, no, no. But yes. You're always ahead of me.
No, I'm not.
But I'll come on in a moment
right.
to where we see the tendency and where the rules are trying to push people. Because what the Practice Direction 57AA says is that there are certain exceptions in relation to proceedings which are started under particular parts.
Right.
But generally speaking, business and property court claims which have significant links, and I quote that, to a particular circuit outside London, or somewhere else in the Southeastern Circuit, because of course London is in the Southeastern Circuit,
yes.
must, and I emphasise that word, be issued in the BPC District Registry in that circuit. Now, I'll get in before you do.
No, do, do please.
What does significant links mean?
Because, I don't know. No, I haven't got a clue.
A question that is begged. Well, exactly. The excitement is almost unbearable. Now, what the practice direction goes on to define where or when a link to a circuit is established, and I apologise here, this is a rather wordy slide.
No, but it's important.
Now, the first potential link is that one or more of the parties has its address or registered office in the circuit in question, and it gives extra weight to the address of any non-represented parties. Now, the next potential link is that at least one of the witnesses expected to give oral evidence at trial or other hearing is located in the circuit. The next is that the dispute occurred in a location within the circuit. The next is that the dispute concerned land, goods or other assets located in the circuit. Or E, so this is the fifth potential link, the party's legal representatives are based in the circuit. And it's also possible to establish a link to a particular circuit if there are already proceedings where there's a significant common question of law or fact with the case that you're about to issue. Now, if you just step back for a moment, some of those categories of link are entirely predictable. Some, perhaps, are slightly more tenuous than one might think. I mean, I think that the one that always strikes me is that at least one of the witnesses expected to give oral evidence at trial is located in the circuit, which you might think is perhaps not
the overwhelming feature.
No, absolutely. And
particularly with 1% of cases ever actually getting to trial.
Yeah, absolutely. So it does sound like a fairly random basis for deciding that not only can, but you must, because the practice direction is in very directive terms.
That's a very odd one, yes.
The party's legal representatives are based in the circuit is, I mean, of course, that's something that tended to happen anyway.
Yes.
You know, if you were... You know, Pinsent Masons in Birmingham in the old days. You'd often issue in Birmingham because it was handy. But what I detect, and I may not be alone in this, is giving people lots of reasons to issue outside of London I suppose in part to relieve the burden on London. But one of the effects, possibly, and I was going to come on to this at the end, you know, what has all this amounted to? Has it, what was it designed to achieve? Has it achieved it? I think is possibly to enhance the kind of specialist importance of regional centres.
Yes.
I mean, places like Manchester, and I mentioned that because I have perhaps more experience of Manchester than any of the other important circuit cities, already had, specialist judges, excellent judges doing
I
really
long ago, Michael Kershaw, who's a wonderful man.
And Judge Pelling, who was there, and I did a trial in front of a couple of years ago, who's now come to run the London Circuit Commercial Court. So they, you know, they didn't need London, and I suppose in a way were far enough away from London for there to be this independent, thriving bar.
Quite and healthy, healthy practice,
absolutely.
Yes.
But I think this is, you know, these reforms, if that's the right word for them, have definitely accentuated that.
And, so to disperse the work.
I think so. And I think, you know, maybe there's also an element, and maybe this is effect rather than intention, of it being more of a kind of career option for, you know, silks in London, leading solicitors in London who want to take up specialist appointments, persuading that it's actually worth going out onto circuit. Whether I think about someone like Malcolm Davis White in Leeds. You know, I mean, it's a serious place to do this sort of work. I mean, some may say it always was, but I think it's ever more true now.
Right. So you're not just getting the scraps off the table.
No. Exactly. And I think there's this encouragement to think that these are serious places. You don't need London. But one of the other things that the practice direction provides for is sending judges out as necessary. So even, I mean, the commercial court doesn't sit outside London, or you can't issue outside London. But I don't know how much it's happened, but there is provision for commercial court judges to be sent to hear a case outside London where, where the need is said to arise. So that's the end of my slides.
But that's a wonderful sort of exposition of what it's about and what goes in there. And I mean, one question is, there still is a tendency, is there not, to try and use London. But I think there may have been some recent litigation, some group action that's in, perhaps in Liverpool or Leeds, where they've said, you know what, we can deal with it up here. And they've resisted applications to to shift it.
Yes, which in a way would be slightly ironic because I wouldn't say these are tensions, but I mean the transfer's meant to be made easier by the business and property court structure in both directions, at least theoretically. But maybe actually the underlying intention is that if something doesn't start in the regions, and I don't mean that pejoratively, then it should be easier to send it there. And of course, the more work that is done there, the more credible it will seem. And I emphasise the word seem, because a lot of these places are perfectly capable of doing work that is routinely done by London, but are not perceived like that. And I think that is going to change. So, I mean, if you ask me what is the effect of all of this been, it's hard for me to know.
It may also be quite early yet.
It may be quite early. I think this is the sort of thing, it probably needs to be tested by reference to statistics, and I'm not aware of any. Anecdote may be more interesting, but perhaps it's not very helpful. Do you see, because this is certainly one of the things that Lord Justice Briggs had in mind, judges hearing cases outside their divisions more, because their expertise is needed. I don't know. I mean, I think of a really terrific judge like Mrs. Justice Carr, to be lost to the Court of Appeal. Now, she was, I think, probably already sitting noticeably often, not necessarily frequently, but in the Chancery Division, where her expertise was needed. And whether that sort of phenomenon has increased, I haven't...
But then doing an awful lot of murder cases as well, and
yes, well, quite.
Well, it's a bit of a waste of an asset, you might imagine. But
Well, I don't know. Maybe it's light relief compared to some of the things on trials in the commercial court.
Well, maybe so. Maybe so.
But I mean, if I suppose, just to finish off, I suppose. I mean, I was thinking about as I was walking here, you know, this idea about moving the boundary. And if one had to, and I know that people like diagrams nowadays, but it's beyond me so far as slides is concerned. You know, this idea of moving the boundary is perhaps the best way of describing what has happened. That perhaps hitherto you had two circles, one was the Chancery Division and one was the Queen's Bench Division. And what you now have is an overlap where the Business and Property Courts encompasses the whole of the Chancery Division and a bit of the Queen's Bench Division. It leaves untouched all the things like public law and personal injury and all that sort of things, which is in the... And that perhaps is, and if you wanted to think of it kind of visually, that would be quite a good way of imagining
A clear image. Brilliant. Okay, thank you. Right, I'm going to now just say a bit about, I'm not going to recite all of this, but about the disclosure pilot scheme, which began on the 1st of January 2019 in the Business and Property Courts. It is, as we're about to see, it is challenging, it is radical. I have to say, we'll get to there, I think it is troublesome as well. Just at the outset, what Shannon was talking about, you know, about clients and servicing the needs of clients, one major detail about the pilot scheme is that it came about because of pressure from clients rather than the MOJ taking an initiative. And the group, the 100 General Counsel, apparently said, we're sick to death of disclosure. It is so expensive that if you don't sort this out, we'll take our work elsewhere. And you might say, well, where would they go? And there were noises about, well, we could resort to arbitration, we'd abandon the courts. There's a new dispute resolution centre working in English that's operating out of Amsterdam. There was genuine concern. And so that is why reform has been implemented. We are, what, 15 months into a two-year pilot scheme. I'll give my view on its life expectancy in a bit. But anyway, we have this pilot scheme running. One interesting detail is because it's not the first stab at trying to curb disclosure, or indeed discovery, as it was once called. Lord Wolfe in 1999 had a go. 2013, and I think he's probably sore about this. Sir Rupert Jackson tried to resolve problems, as he tried to resolve everything wrong with civil procedure, by producing a so-called disclosure menu in 2013, which gave the court a range of options as to how wide disclosure might be. And standard disclosure, which is seen as sort of both the lazy and the onerous option, I think comes in about fifth in that pecking order. And Sir Rupert Jackson has certainly said, not attacking this pilot scheme, but he certainly said, well, you know, if the judiciary had used the powers that I provided them with in 2013, we wouldn't need to have further reform. Because, so for example, in the Jackson menu, we had options like, well, only disclose documents about events between these two dates, or only disclose documents relating to this specific issue. And if those powers had been used, then I think his view, and I have to say on this, I agree with him. I don't always, but I do on this, is that this really would have perhaps eased the pressure. But anyway, we have the reforms brought in by way of practice direction. An interesting detail, why practice direction? Because if there was a problem identified, then it could be adjusted overnight. You'll appreciate that changing the rules takes months and months, if not years, whereas a practice direction literally could be adjusted overnight. And so they had that flexibility built in. The one important decision on the pilot scheme last year from Sir Geoffrey Voss is that, contrary to what various commentators had suggested, the new powers, and I'm going to talk a little bit about them in a moment, the new powers can be applied to cases where the first disclosure order was made prior to implementation, prior to 1st of January 2019. So current orders will remain in place, but it is open to the court to draw upon the new powers if it so wishes. So that's really the where it all came from. The next critical feature to mention, again briefly, is that there are obligations, which again I won't recite, but there are very specific obligations imposed upon the legal representatives and upon the clients. And I think it is crucial that people, litigators, are clear with their clients about what these obligations are, because if something goes wrong, it's not difficult to envisage a client saying, well, my lawyers never told me or never explained this. So making sure that you get that message across to clients is critically important. Obligations, which again are not necessarily new, but are now enshrined in the rules. So the need to preserve documents, the need to comply with orders, and then just spelling out things that were fundamental anyway, the need to act honestly. The one obligation I thought was very clever, number six on the list, is an obligation not to disclose, material that is irrelevant. And that's important because in the past, well, one, I think some people were just bone idle, lazy, and they just chuck everything out because that's a lot easier than making a conscious effort to sift. But perhaps more worryingly, I'm sure a very small minority, but I suspect there were some people who would throw a wall of paper or documentation at an opponent to blind them, to overwhelm them, and to make them, oh, well, yeah, and perhaps get them to think, oh, God, we'll never cope with this, and just to give up the ghost. So I thought that was a very clever thing to add to the list there.
Well, just on that last point.
Please, do.
There's also, I mean, perhaps with more unscrupulous people, that tendency to try to bury bad news by a kind of dump of information, which contains the smoking gun document.
But it's 8 feet down, and it's bad. So I thought that was good. And since the whole point of this is trying to save time and money, then imposing a positive obligation not to disclose, I think, really furthers that objective.
Yes.
Thank you. Great. Legal representatives, again, very clear obligations. Specifically, I thought, the one that really caught my eye is number three on this slide, namely an obligation to cooperate and cost-effective conduct, including the use of technology. And we'll come back to technology in a moment. But again, spelling out obligations, core obligations, and trying to keep people on the straight and narrow. Now, these duties are ongoing. Again, the duty to preserve is everything. There is one duty that I couldn't get my head around, and I still can't. This is the duty which requires a party to write to all employees, and here's the rub, former employees, to ensure that documents be preserved and not be deleted. I struggle with that. Why, when you have people leaving your employment, you'd always have an obligation for them to hand over all materials. How likely is it that they'd even want to cooperate? They may have left against their will. So I thought that was a step, I have to say, a step too far. But anyway, those are the duties, and that is how things stand at the moment. There's one very important practical point, and it is about budgeting, cost management. Cost management rules are crucial, sanction brutal, 314, no budget, no costs. And if you leave a blank, can I point out, this is what they are told in judicial training. If a judge in a budget sees that legendary phrase, to be advised, they just scrub it out and put in zero. So every item in a budget should be costed, except here. Paragraph 22.2, if you are caught by budgeting in the pilot scheme, you are allowed with agreement of your opponent. So this is not unilateral, but you are allowed with agreement of your opponent to leave out of the process altogether the cost of disclosure. And I suggest that's actually a very good thing to reach agreement upon, because frankly, you won't know that the nature of the obligation, how little, how much you're going to get. So why waste time even having a stab, making a wild guesstimate at the cost? So far better that you agree to leave it out, you get your directions on disclosure, and then of course you will be required, and I think promptly, to supply figures, but at least you'll know exactly the size of the obligation, and I think therefore you can gauge it, you can cost it more effectively. That's the one area where it is legitimate to have a blank in a budget. That's a solitary exception to a very harsh general rule. Now, in terms of the bones of the pilot scheme, we have initial disclosure, which is really about disclosing alongside your statement. Okay, so again, very front-loading, another criticism, an awful lot going on at the beginning. The key documents upon which you rely and any further material that you think your opponents need to see in order to comprehend the nature of your case. Now, again, parties can agree to opt out of initial disclosure. I set out the criteria there on the slide for so doing. Again, anecdotally, because I mean we're not getting reports on this yet, but anecdotally, I think a lot of people are doing that and saying, you know what, let's park it, let's not do this, let's get directions from the court, and then it will be much more forensic. So that's initial disclosure. Beyond initial disclosure, we have, say, various criteria here. But then the next step, potentially down the road, is more disclosure, and this is called extended disclosure. Crucial point is that the rules make it clear there is absolutely no presumption or entitlement to extended disclosure. It is at the behest of the court, and again, I itemise the seven factors identified in the practice direction the court shall have regard to in determining whether there should be extended disclosure. And critically, if there is extended disclosure, then the court can give guidance or directions on how technology can be used. So we've got keyword searches, long established, but also now predictive coding, whereby, as most people I'm sure will appreciate, all the documents are scanned, a sample of the documents is drawn down, you look at those documents and you effectively mark them for relevance. So, you know, 10, you know, red hot smoking gun, one irrelevant. And so that information is then fed back by your software supplier into the process. And what you are thereby doing, you are tutoring the software to think as you think, to look for what you are and aren't interested in, and to distinguish between that material. So that's predictive coding, expensive and elaborate, but it is a way of trying to use technology to make things more efficient. And in Pyro Investments, the court approved the use of predictive coding. And in Brown, the court went further and ordered predictive coding, even though the parties weren't keen upon it. And so the final element is that if there is to be extended disclosure, then there are five models. I just want to briefly sort of skip through them. So first of all, model A disclosure confined to known adverse documents. Again, another criticism of mine is that if we're trying to, you know, get cut to the chase and focus straight away, why on earth aren't adverse documents required to be disclosed at the very outset? I think that'd be, I mean, just if you're talking about transparency, cards on the table, that seems to me much more sensible. Model B is a form of limited disclosure. Now, this, of course, emulates initial disclosure, Model B, i.e. The documents that you rely on and documents that you think your opponent needs to see to comprehend your case. The only difference is that there is no limit on the number of documents. So that's the subtle distinction between what it looks like otherwise identical wording between initial disclosure and Model B, limited extended disclosure. Model C, based on arbitration, I think Redfern schedules, and that is a request-led search-based disclosure. And then we have Model D, which is a narrow, effectively standard disclosure. And then the wildest of them all, of course, Model E, is open-ended train of inquiry, Peruvian guano disclosure. And please note that in the way that we go through the various models there, A to E, the most gentle obligation is at the A end of the spectrum, and the widest is Model E. And indeed, there is a provision in the direction that Models D and E in particular are least likely to be granted, because what we're trying to do is to rein in the amount of disclosure that we have. So that's the nature of the model. I then set out on the slides, which I won't recite to you, the incredibly laborious process of completing a disclosure review document. You'll see there that there are 10 steps, and if you go through all of them, you are weeks and weeks down the road. And I have to say, I can't help thinking that this is just too too much. So that's the model anyway. And I just want to, in closing, if we could ask Shantanu what his feelings are. I've told you mine already. I speak to an awful lot of lawyers, and I have to find somebody yet who is in favour of this. So I'm afraid it has not gone down well. But that's my sort of on the road experience. And I wonder how it is from counsel's perspective.
Well, I mean, I'm not that person if you're looking for someone who's in favour of it. I mean, I'm just going to pick up on the known adverse documents point, because you're right, it's an odd one. I mean, if you're going to have front-loaded disclosure and, you know, query whether one should, that shouldn't be there. And but all the more so because one of the particular considerations when they were trying to decide what to do was they were recognising, now, there may be a difference of opinion amongst international litigants about this, depending on whether they have adverse documents or not. But certainly the working party considered that ability to obtain adverse documents as a matter of obligation from the other side was a distinct attraction of the courts of England and Wales as compared to many other jurisdictions. So why it's not automatic.
Yes. And at the forefront, centre stage, I'm I'm bemused.
Absolutely.
That.
And as I say, it depends who you are, because of course we all know litigants who not only don't understand why, but really don't want to disclose adverse documents.
No, ignorance is bliss, yes.
Indeed. But yes, I mean, more broadly, I mean, I confess that I have not, I don't think I've heard anyone say a good word about this.
No.
And which is not to say, and I think...
And the people behind it, I mean, people like Ed Cross at Simmons & Simmons, Colin Passmore, fabulous people. But I can't help feeling it's been hijacked somewhere, because I think they'd be much more circumspect in their approach. But this is where we are. And the great story, I'm told, is that solicitors hate doing it, so they send it to counsel. Yes. Counsel hates doing it, but they've got to do it because they're instructed to do it. So it is an unhappy state of affairs.
It is. I mean, I confess that I've managed generally to dodge that bullet.
Very good.
But I've done it enough to know how undesirable it is to do. And it's one thing doing something which you don't want to do and which is laborious, but which you can see the point of.
Sure.
But I think that's the difficulty.
Yeah.
I think that's where you lose the will.
Yes.
But even it's like all of these things, it's not only well-meaning, but devised by people who knew what they were talking about.
Oh, God, yes.
And to address a genuine problem.
Yes.
But this isn't the answer.
No, and, no. We've got the problem. We haven't got the right answer.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, what I think this does do, and I think what it recognises, because I think, you know, I remember, I'm sure we did a webinar back in 2013 about the menu option.
Yes, yes.
I think a couple of years ago I was with some other people on the panel with you talking about about this disclosure pilot.
Yes.
And I think one of the concerns I had was that, you know, there was this kind of inheritance aspect to, you know, people who grew up with train of inquiry.
Yes. It's hard to shake that off.
And maybe just about managed to embrace standard disclosure. But whatever their thinking was, it ended up being the default option. And you sort of pass that on to the people who you train.
Yes.
Now, I think this recognised that problem, because it has made it much harder to just sink back into doing it
Indeed.
In the usual way, but in a way which I just think is so disproportionate and unhelpful.
Well, that's the problem.
So
we will see.
Yeah.
We'll see. End of the year. Anyway, thanks to Shantanu QC. And thank you for joining us. And it's been, I hope that's made sense. And it's been an education for me. It really has. And I hope it has been for you as well. So thank you. Thank you.